My name is Ann Basie, and I have been presenting this week on simple living. And there have been a lot of staff people here. 10:50 in the morning is a time when almost no staff people can come, so that's why our numbers are so small, I think. Today's class session is called Church Basements as Cells of Resistance. And I was thinking after I called it that, you know, I grew up in a church with no basement, of course, in California. We had a social hall. But 26 years of living in Chicago and going to a church with a basement kind of gave me the basement framework, but I was realizing, of course, that's a really Midwestern thing. Not everybody has a basement. So church basement and or social hall as cells of resistance could be our title. So was anybody here on Monday when this started? Okay. Would you mind if I just repeated a few things from Monday? Okay, thank you. I want to just reintroduce myself and my task for the book, and then we have a lot of work to do about how you can all go home, revolutionaries. My name is Ann Basie, and I'm from California, went to school in Washington, been to Holden Village a lot. I'm leaving Chicago this fall. I'm after a long and wonderful life there. And I did write this book called Sustaining Simplicity, a Journal, which the ELCA World Hunger Appeal published. So I was asked to write it to help promote, open up, and increase the level of conversation within the ELCA around questions of lifestyle and our own stewardship of money and time and stuff. So just briefly to let you know, the note here says, buy the book. It's in the bookstore, and there are brochures up here. Really briefly, the life that I was living in Chicago, which now, you know, is changing. I don't feel like I've been living simply lately. I feel like I've been packing. But previously, before I sold my house and made all these changes, I've been living for quite a while without a car in Chicago. And Chicago's a very easy place to do that. Bikes, car sharing, CTA, carpools, walking, density. Not hard to do that there. It would be difficult in a less urban place. Don't buy a lot, a few clothes. I often shop Potty Patrol, year-round clothes there from Holden. Did a lot of recycling, tried to work on community, like inviting the LVC community to live in my house while I was gone. Just to let you know, we were talking yesterday at sort of the messages around simple living and some of the fears, and somebody said there are more what-ifs with simple living because there's less security. But really, my life has been pretty middle class. I mean, for the last few years, I had a full-time job. Before that, I was freelance. But I always managed to have insurance. So somebody who had a simple life and an IRA, and they're not really incompatible. You do need to take care of yourself. One of my colleagues, after she read the book, said, "Oh, Ann, I get it. You're just a hippie with expensive tastes." So that was her analysis after she read this. And it's true that when I turned the manuscript in, there were some reviewers, and one reviewer came back and said, "But Ann, you talk about wine more than you talk about God." So I had to go change that before the book came out.
Less wine or
more
God?
More God. And a little less wine. So you could argue, I think, whether it's a simple life or not. On Monday, we also took some time to look at all the different ways and the different emphases that you can call simple, from environmental to communal living and intentional and faith-based. There's a lot of different ways. I would say that what I've tried to do is live intentionally more than simply. And whenever anybody is trying to live intentionally, then you're reflecting on your choices more and thinking about and trying to make choices that embody some values. So living like this has led me to ask lots of questions and try to look at the alternatives. And many of them, of course, I think come from our own gospel. There's a lot of encouragement in the gospel to go against the grain. And so some of the questions that, you know, I was asking myself as I was writing this book, which kind of was putting together how I live. And if we say our values come from the gospel, then how can we try to make sure that we really live them? A question for everybody involved in any faith community. If the gospel tells us to love one another as ourselves, then how do we live as if others matter? You know, does that mean buying cheap stuff that was made by people who were paid very little? There are, you know, endless ethical dimensions to this when you begin questioning. So my goal basically is to get more people to ask these questions about their lives. Tuesday we were looking at values and lenses, and you know, what are the values at the core of American culture that lead us to live certain ways, because structures have been built around those values that make it really easy for us to own cars, commute to work, and et cetera, et cetera. It's difficult to find alternatives when the structures support a way of life based on values that we forget to question. So my goal is just to make people say, you know, why do we live this way? What would be some other alternatives that better express our own values? And I think that the church or the faith community would be a key partner in this. It has been, and I think it will be. Last week, during El Brianda Caminos, we had a really great Bible study with David Vasquez, who's the pastor at the campus chaplain, I think, at Luther College in Decorah, Iowa. And it was all about we only got through about the first five books of Exodus. It was a very small amount of text. And the title of it was Moses, the First Wetback? ? And so in Spanish, it was a very slow walk through this story with lots of space for people to bring their own questions to it. But every day David would ask this question, remind people this question, ¿Qué tienes en tu mano? What do you have in your hand? So that as we were looking at the text and as we were talking about each other's lives, we would always be aware of the assets that we have that we bring to our situations. So it was very asset-based. What do you have in your hand? Not what am I going to do, but what have you been equipped with that you can begin to use to move forward and take the first step? So last night and this morning then, I was making a big list to myself of all of the assets that churches, congregations, church basements, social halls have that we bring to the task of looking at our lives and contemplating alternatives. So I came up with 9 of them. There may be more, but I'm going to jump up and down here as I read my notes and write it on the board. The first asset that I came up with that just seems to be part of church is that we have a long tradition of the church questioning the dominant culture from the very beginning. It was an alternative, and questions have arisen from that. So even recently, if you can look at some, you know, major social issues like civil rights or the abolition of slavery, if you read those histories, the church has always taken a lead in asking some of these questions. So tradition of inquiry and resistance is one that I would say is an asset of the church. Second one is just the fact that church is a place where people gather. There's invitation. People come together, and in a culture that can be very individualistic, we are invited to do things together in the community. So the church maintains a focus on community in the middle of an individualistic society. You know, we worship together, we make meals together, we have coffee together, we sing together, we have work days together. I have here, okay, we argue together over everything from worship practices to the budget, but we still argue together. So the church lifts up a communal example in the middle of a very individualistic culture. Third asset that occurred to me would be something, a property of the local congregation, and that is most local congregations have very deep roots in the community, and there's a lot of local wisdom sitting around the table. When I first moved to Chicago, it was after I'd, you know, lived in California and Washington and Massachusetts and traveled to Europe, and I was sort of exploring. And so when I got to Chicago, I thought, you know, it's time to be a citizen. It's time to settle down and be part of a community. So when I went to church, the first thing that my congregation did for me was open the door to that community. So I would meet PTA presidents and neighbors and people who ran stores. All of those people with deep community connections were sitting around the table. And so almost any question you have can be answered by somebody that you're sitting with if it's about your own neighborhood. I think that's true even in transit communities, because there's always somebody who's an old timer. Let's call it that. Old timers. And a fourth asset is one that is important to me. Really, if you think about it, church space is almost the only public space left in the United States that isn't devoted to shopping or consuming. It's not its purpose. Mm-hmm. Think about malls, think about all the other public squares. Largely these days, they're devoted to commerce. I mean, we do that too when we have cookie sales and stuff, but it's not the main purpose. So that's one reason why church space is public space. It's used for classes, workshops, daycare centers, yoga classes, you name it. It happens in church buildings because they have accessible, cheap space where people can meet. The very first simple living group I ever went to was in 1997, and it was at Old St. Patrick's Church, Catholic Church in downtown Chicago. And they just, as part of their outreach to the community, had a lot of space for many kinds of groups. So I went to a church the first time I met in the same room with people who wanted to say, how should we live? So, abundant, cheap, public meeting space, usually cheap.
Well, in a lot of cases, there is some commercial thing going on there, but it's not the main focus of the space.
It's not the main, yeah.
Yeah. Like we're in Italy, and the square is in front of the church. There'd be a market one day, but then there were other things going the rest of the week.
Yeah.
Community events.
But it's not like a mall.
Right.
No. It's not the only thing to do there. You can leave a dollar behind for your coffee. Also, I think that churches, faith, our worship lifts up gratefulness in a culture that's very consumer-oriented. You can kind of think of consumerism as the opposite of gratefulness. There's a quote from Madeline L'Engle that I put in the book here. That kind of sums that up. She says, probably the worst thing that has happened to our understanding of reality has been our acceptance of ourselves as consumers. Our greed is consuming the planet so that we may quite easily kill this beautiful earth by daily pollution without ever having nuclear warfare. Sex without love consumes, making another person an object, not a subject. Can we change our vocabulary and thinking? To do so may well be a matter of life and death. Consumers do not understand that we must live not by greed and self-indulgence, but by observing and contemplating the wonder of God's universe as it is continually being revealed to us. So wonder, contemplation, gratefulness, a sense of abundance, all those things stand against a consumer mentality that uses up what it sees instead of appreciating it. So appreciation and gratitude. We build it into worship, we build it into prayer. In many ways, I had another quote from Scientific American. We have inherited a tendency to notice the negative more readily than the positive. The natural human condition is to take positive experiences for granted and to focus on the bothersome aspects of life. So in our paradigm, where praise and gratefulness and thankfulness is at the center, that really works against that. So this is another asset that we have, which I have appreciation and gratitude. Gratefulness. I'm not even going to the theological statement that there's a source for something else, for other things besides ourselves. That would be up here too now that I'm thinking about it. Not consumer. Number six, on Monday, back in our, here's my little intro group, you were all here when someone pointed out that there is no infrastructure for sharing in our culture. You know, there's an infrastructure for buying, it's difficult to share. I would say church is the closest thing that we kind of come to find an infrastructure of sharing. For sharing goods and services. Oh, here's one of my favorite. Here's another one. We have a pulpit. If the pastor's into it, there's an audience every week, and somebody can proclaim on this again and again and again. I hope not in a bullying, shaming way, but in an invitation. But the pulpit, space to listen, people to talk to, that's good. Also, I would think we have a liturgical calendar that's pretty powerful. So in the church, we acknowledge that there might be seasons for abundance and celebration, and then there's seasons for, not really self-denial, but you know, something more like Lent, where there's more discipline and more fasting. So we through the church we have access to a rhythm that's distinctly different from consume all the time. And that's another place. And now I switch to global mission and say that also within the church we have global relationships and global accountability. Lutheran Church, we're ELCA, we're a member of the Lutheran World Federation. All told, there are about 141, 142 churches that belong, about 66 million Lutherans. And within that, the ELCA has its 80 bilateral relationships with companion synods. Some of you may be involved in companion synods in your own synod. Maybe your synod relates to a diocese of Tanzania or El Salvador. Or within that, maybe even your congregation has a sister relationship. So we have this thread of relationships, global relationships, within which we can get to know each other, hear each other's voices, and be accountable in a way that we don't have to be outside of church. There's more sense of that. You know, we know some of the people who are being affected by our choices. I would say this is a long-winded way of saying that the church really gives us permission to inquire, to ask questions, and to resist. It's a place that's, and for all of these reasons, we already have a lot in our hand within our congregations that makes them a really great place to take up the banner and get to work revolutionizing our country. So then I spent some time thinking about within these assets, how can we put these assets together to offer one another support. A big theme this week in these conversations has been how important it is to have support when you're trying to do something a little bit different, just like an AA meeting. You know, you just need support to help you whenever you're making a life change. Larry?
Another one you're missing there is local relationships.
Local relationships.
Our church is cooperating a lot more with other denominations in the area than I ever remember having.
Yeah.
Anybody else want to add more to this? Or if you think of any as we're
Too. Our community, for instance, last year, the homeless shelter was overflowing. And so there were about 7 or 8 churches, different denominations that got together. And we would all offer 2 weeks of having shelter for these homeless people.
And rotating it.
And,
so maybe what you're looking at is, we also talked a little bit about how sometimes it can be hard to collaborate. Same as infrastructure for sharing. We'll do that. And collaboration for sharing assets instead of duplicating them. I can't get over that far. Just to go a little more on the global thing, I only have a couple copies and I can't figure out how to use that copy right there. I can print off it, but I can't make copies. If you're involved in a relationship with another congregation, a global congregation or in a companion synod thing, oftentimes there'll be opportunities to get to hear the perspective of the people you're in relationship with on American culture, on American consumption, on environmental use. So I brought two that I'll just pass them around because I'm afraid I couldn't copy. These two, these are the same thing. These were newsletters from missionaries who've come back now, but they worked for a year as communications consultants to the Lutheran World Federation in Cambodia through the ELCA. They were our missionaries, although they're Canadian. And this is a report of the Cambodian LWF project looking at how it's teaching, not just teaching global warming, but how they're teaching adaptation to what global warming is doing. And there's quite a lot of prophecy here about our role on the second side. There was quite a lot of a critique about North American overconsumption. And this comes from people who are working with Cambodians every day and are seeing the effect of global changes on their environment. And this is even better, and I wish we could all have copies. This is a page I copied from a Bible study that came from Tanzania, the Lutheran, I think it's called the Lutheran Coordinating Mission, which is a board that meets twice a year that Evangelical Lutheran Church in Tanzania brings all of its institutional heads and diocese bishops, and then all of the international churches are present, so the Church of Denmark, the Church of Finland, Finn Church Age, the Germans, all of the different funding mission agencies and the ELCA to look to, and then the ELCT, the Tanzanian Church, talks about what they're doing in ministry, and then it's a way to sort of coordinate support so that the ministry of the ELCT is supported. So this was a Bible study that was led by a pastor on the issue of, it's called the Bible Study, the Church and Environmental Responsibility. And this, the section called The Problem, we'll pass it around, is him just saying, what are all the ramifications of global warming in his own community? Plus, apparently there's, for a cash crop, there's eucalyptus plantations that are taking over the land that used to be communal, where you could grow vegetables. Now it's privately owned and the money goes somewhere else. So it kind of looks at environment, trade, consumption. And then under this, the evil causes of the crisis, he's quoting someone else, and unfortunately he's never attributed it, but it talks a little bit about the West's point of view of Africa. For industrial countries, Africa is simply a vast plantation, a huge market, innumerable sales points, an immense dumping ground, a place for leisure and a reservoir for labor and jobs. And then kind of looking at the African, through the African lens of how Westerners interact with Africa. So through global relationships, they're a real asset for us because we really can hear voices that we wouldn't hear in the media, voices that are often screened out. So how do we use these assets to deepen these conversations in our own congregations? I have several suggestions, and then I'm happy to, we can go back to our conversation as we've done every single day. Has anybody been in a small church-based simplicity group? Simplicity groups or simplicity circles bring together about 8 or 10 people who are interested in looking at the way they live and considering alternatives. Usually there's kind of a curriculum that can guide you through it, so you don't just sit around saying, now what, which is hard to do. People have been down the road before. It's nice to use their resources to kind of structure the conversation. I was talking with Elizabeth over coffee, who knows Cecile Andrews, who is in Seattle. She's written a lot on simple living, and this is stuff you can Google. I think I have a handout at the end, too. Cecile Andrews started this technique called simplicity circles, and she has, there's a book about it, and I think you can also find on the web some downloadable guides, but it's like an eight-week inquiry that looks at, you know, culture and everything we've done this week, basically, looking at values, structure, and how we fit into it and how we might make changes. Simplicity circles. And so there's a good outline for the beginning of a group. And, of course, there's this one, which is a place to start. The Northwest Earth Institute in Portland has a lot of these similar sort of small group. It's not really a curriculum. It's more of a discussion guide. Readings, questions that help you look at the reading, and then questions you can ask to each other. It's structured to get a lot of material out of us as we're talking and bridges those awkward moments when no one has anything to say. Northwest Earth Institute in Portland has some similar materials, and theirs really look at sustainability. So if you're looking, if you're moving into that question, what is sustainability, what does it have to do with us, and what can we do? They have some excellent, again, about 8 week materials. Anybody ever worked at, seen the Your Money or Your Life materials? Because you're, okay. Your Money or Your Life, it's the New Roadmap Foundation, is that their name? Something like that. I think in Seattle. New Roadmap Foundation. These are tools that would get the conversation started in your congregation. The name of the book is Your Money or Your Life, and it's on its second edition now, and that's a very interesting look at the economy, money, how we relate to money, how we relate personally to money, and then it pushes you to look at your expenses and start to line up your spending. So what doesn't give you any joy, you just stop spending money on, and if there's, you know, music lessons are more important than car washes, then you would wash the car yourself and learn the viola. It's a way to really look, it's good instruction in how to make your spending and your life begin to match your values. I know that they used to do a congregational-based study guide that had a lot of Bible quotes in it. So if you go to their website, take a look at that, but because I think they said that, you know, we always say that do not be afraid is the phrase that's most often used in the Bible, and I think there's hundreds and hundreds of citations where Jesus talks about money, and they're all picked up on in the congregation-based one. Other resources would be the things that come from Alternatives for Simple Living, which is the faith-based group that the Lutheran Church World Hunger Money gives them a grant every year. It's interdenominational. Now they're based in Colorado. And they are the ones who published the little pamphlet called Whose Birthday Is It Anyway? At Christmas, which has a lot of alternative worships and prayers and gifts ideas. That congregations can order that in bulk. Whose birthday is it anyway? So, if you're looking at the liturgical year, this is something that can help you focus on Christmas. The thing is, it always, well, it's probably out in September. You know, November 1st is almost too late to look at Christmas. You have to kind of start thinking about it earlier. You can get this, I think, probably starting October 1st. So, a small group, one way to use the public space, the permission to ask questions, is to convene in your congregation, either for congregation members or opening it up to the public. What I forgot to say was, sorry, this is a big asset and kind of a mandate. If the church has always, if the tradition of Christianity and of faith groups is to critique and go against the dominant culture, then it would seem like a church's real strength would be to offer something different on Sunday than people get Monday through Friday. If we're articulating the same thing as a dominant culture, I don't think we're being who we need to be. So starting simplicity circles that let people understand that you're going to be trying to articulate some alternatives, I think is even a strong outreach tool for your congregation because it shows you're thinking differently. Other small groups, I was in a small group for probably about 4 years. We started with thinking, then it was just sort of, we looked at simplicity, we looked at the Your Money, Your Life, which was very powerful for me. We talked a lot about the different things we were doing. It was a great place to share information. Ultimately, there was a smaller, more neighborhood group that broke off, so we wouldn't have to go so far. We started to look at sustainability. We really had a great time, too. They were wonderful people to get to know. But there was enough to look at that over the course of about 3 years, we met, I think by the end we were doing it maybe once a month or once every 6 weeks, because people are busy. But it was a really great way to share not just information, but practices. So at some point, if the group stays together, it might look more at the house. And that's where sharing and all these other alternative things can come up. Liturgical calendar events. Advent is a natural place. Christmas, whose birthday is it anyway? I do have to make a commercial and say that after I wrote this book, my sister and brother-in-law, who are also writers, invited me to be part of a book called Green Christmas, How to Have a Happy and Joyous Eco-Friendly Holiday. And it came out last December, and probably they'll do it again this Christmas. It's a little tiny book, kind of a countertop book that looks at Christmas too. Lent, there's a lot of opportunity during Lent to really examine simple living. A powerful thing that some churches have been doing is instead of having a more traditional fast, they've been doing plastic fasts. So for 40 days, look at plastic. Where is it? How's it made? Where does it come from? And try to just see what you can do to live without plastic for 40 days. You know, taking your own bag with you, not using water bottles. It just makes you aware. It's a lens-changing activity. Because all of a sudden you really see the plastic around you instead of take it for granted. I think if you just Google plastic fast, you'll see there's quite a few sites that have talked about it and some churches that can tell you how it went. But that's a new spin on Lent, I think, for churches who are wondering what to do with this Lent. Of course, our own churches are laboratories for greening the church. I talked a little bit a few days ago about my small congregation where, and forgive me if you were here to hear this, but of course, we had coffee hour with styrofoam cups, and I would hate that. But a young woman started to come to church who just began to bring her ceramic mug to church every Sunday and sit there in the middle of the people drinking the styrofoam and use her mug. And then she would rinse it out and put it on the shelf and come back and do the same thing. So I thought, oh, let me see where that goes. Well, sure enough, about a year later, there's no more styrofoam. There's paper, some insulated paper for people who prefer that. And then there's a selection of mugs. And then we just, this is a small church. This is not a 1,000-member church, so maybe we have more flexibility. There's a bucket of hot water that gets set up at the sink, and the agreement is that you'll just wash your own. So in a small way, we took a step that really did make a difference. The same young woman said, don't we have some glass communion cups hanging around someplace? And she went and she found them, and she brought them back out, and she set up a schedule so that we use them every week, and then again, they're washed the same way that monks are. So I had also explained the other day that my church went through this value process, value clarifying process, and a new mission statement. And one of the values that emerged was that we would be this urban green space, you know, where the love of Christ is shared in acts of love, and it goes on from there to get more theological. But the first words are, we are an urban green space, that. So once that was set up as our criterion, people had to see things differently. So not long after we voted this, somebody stood up and said, oh, the sexton needs some more cleaning supplies. We need a bunch of Lysol. And I was thinking, ooh, that's interesting. And sure enough, a week later, they said, you know, the council thought if we're an urban green space, we better think about that Lysol again. And so then we started to look for how could we use different materials. So setting the goal of becoming an urban green space made people start, just sort of avoided the conversation about what was the most cost-effective product to buy, and made people look more at what type of product, cleaning product we'll be using. So your church can be a laboratory for it. There's plenty of practices. Let's see, Walt was here the other day and talked about how their church put solar panels up on the roof, and they're selling electricity back to the utility in Milwaukee. A lot of exciting things that churches are doing. There are certainly a lot of events, community events that we could be offering as congregations. Of course, a lot of people already sell fair trade coffee or do alternative gift events. Those are popular. Building on the asset of community focus and community meals, there's a lot of space for people to maybe have some kind of a community meal that uses locally grown food and invites people to look at the local food system, local food security. That could be an interesting event. Free cycling. Anybody ever been to a free cycle? Okay, all right. I was thinking you're all ahead of me. Free cycling is what it sounds like. It's like recycling but giving things away free. So one of the evangelical free churches in my neighborhood decided to offer a free cycle. They too are trying to kind of take this green space niche in our neighborhood. And they let everybody in the neighborhood know that they were going to do a free cycle. So you could bring your own stuff. The basement and the sidewalk of the church were open. You just brought what you had that you wanted to give away, and then you could take home what you wanted to, much like the potty patrol here. So I had a lot of old pots, clay pots. I brought them all in, and of course they were gone 5 minutes later. And then I think I came home with two books and a printer that also didn't work, but I gave it a shot. Anyway, it was pretty cool to see all these different people from the neighborhood bringing their stuff, and nearly everything was gone. And then they recycled the computers, the equipment at the end that they would take to the landfill, or not the landfill, but the alternative place where they take care of computers. So a free cycle is an interesting thing. You know, we're so used to doing the church rummage sale. The church free cycle is an interesting alternative to that. That kind of, you know, you're really supporting the economy of grace. Special guests who can help us see through other lenses. Missionaries. If you have missionaries, people who used to be missionaries, I always find, I think, Sunita too, when we work with the missionaries in the Global Mission Office, that because they lived outside U.S. cultures, they are Americans who lived outside, which heightens their ability to see lenses on both sides, and they are often really powerful sources of information on how did they live, what was it like to come back, what did they notice when they came back. Angela Gustafson and Trevor, they have the little baby, they're on long-term staff here. Her parents, they both were raised, they met at a missionary boarding school in Cameroon or Central African Republic, and I remember her mother telling me that when their family came back and they went through their re-entry process, that Angie and her sister were really offended because when it came time for the teenage program, they took them shopping. Like, that was re-entry to American culture. Go to the mall. It was embarrassing. That was not an ELCA reentry program. It was an ecumenical reentry program. So to talk to missionaries is to really hear a lot about other values. Recently, I did the simple living thing with the missionaries at the ELCA Global Mission Conference, about the missionary conference a few weeks ago. And, you know, oftentimes what missionaries say is, first of all, it's hard to step out of our really busy lifestyle, and we've hardly talked about time this week. We've focused more on stuff and environment, but it's difficult to leave a busy lifestyle and go live someplace where somebody said, like, scheduled nothingness was how one young man put it. He had to kind of schedule doing nothing. It took him a long time, but once he got more used to it, then he became really enamored of this rhythm of life in which there was more time for coffee or making meals with people. Then you come back here, and several of the missionaries said, the thing is, you come home, and no one ever invites you into their house to eat. They just want to take you out. They just want to go out for coffee. We want to go out to eat. We want to go out for coffee. We've almost stopped inviting people into our homes again. And so they really have some loneliness sometimes, because the situations they've lived in have been so socially interactive. You know, a meal will take 4 hours, or the church, you know, worship you hear in some places is 6 hours long. There was one who worked in France. She said in France, there's an international congregation there. There was a parish dinner every Sunday afternoon from noon to five. No lawn mowing. Sunday afternoon was quiet time for everybody in this village where she was. So there's a lot of wisdom and other perspectives to be shared by people who have lived out of the country, or if they're people who are international students or visiting from others. Other, again, the same way, just ask, what's life like? Well, what's life like is a very bad question. Tell us about how dinner happens. Something more specific would be a way to begin to kind of share and hear other perspectives. What's this last one? Oh, apply the lens of lifestyle to all committees. One reason that the World Hunger Appeal wanted to have this book was to encourage us not just to look at our own generosity and our own inclination to look at problems somewhere else, but to start to put ourselves into the equation. If you think about it, there's a lot of congregations and different groups, NGOs, who are all about putting wells around the world. Okay, fresh water, fresh water, fresh water. Nobody ever says, is it okay for us to, you know, turn the water on, go away and do something else, water the lawn all day. We never look at our own use or our own respect for our water sources here. We never consider what possible water conflicts and rights situations are here. We just leave ourselves out of the equation while we go focus on a problem that we define as somewhere else. And I think within our churches, we have an opportunity to start to close that by looking at our own values and behavior every single time, so we don't always define the problem as elsewhere. In a Lutheran World Federation bulletin that was on wealth and poverty, the editor said, you know, we always study poverty. We never study wealth. The problem is poverty. We don't look at our own stewardship and our own use of wealth. How did we get it? How do we use it? We don't even touch that one. So how do we start to bring that into how we are church, how we live as people of faith, in the way our church make decisions or engages in ministry, or as individuals what we do. So this is the end of my dump here on church basements and social halls as cells of resistance. But to me, it is important that we recognize the assets we have, we recognize the permission the gospel gives us to ask these questions, and we find ways that we can begin to talk and support one another as we, well, I would say, change American culture to something that's more sustainable and life-giving through our own actions and through our group advocacy and public policy decisions. That's me. But I think the church is an excellent place to have that happen. Any other stories? You were LDCers? All of you? Mm-hmm. All of you are in Chicago in the Lisbon Volunteer Corps?
Yes,
St. Paul.
St. Paul. St. Paul. And, okay, do you want to talk? So you have had some experience living in community then, right? Mm-hmm. Sort of like Holden Village all year long?
Right? Sort of like.
Sort of?
But in a big city.
In a big city, okay. And then as LVCers, then did you relate to a congregation? Or were you at your own kind of house church?
Yeah, they have like host congregations that are close to our apartments.
Mm-hmm.
For, in Chicago, for example, there are 3 different apartments, and there's a host congregation for each of them where you can go, but it's also very open to finding your own faith community, whatever that is for you.
And a stated goal, I think, if you're here in LVC is to practice a simple lifestyle. Mm-hmm. So can you tell us? I don't know what you've learned or something you'd like to share with us. Why don't you turn around and talk to anybody else? I don't want to just have the conversation with you.
I'll talk a little bit about food because that is what kind most and what I've enjoyed about even just being at Holden for a day so far is continuing that. But thinking about where our food comes from and how we, why we eat what we eat, and eating lower on the food chain, eating less meat, which is something that I didn't do a lot of until I started my year with LVC. And so kind of being conscious of where food comes from, but then also what we're eating. And I mean, it's not just a cost thing. Yes, it was a lot cheaper to cook our own beans and have tofu and that sort of thing. But also just thinking about how the impact on the earth and less packaging and less processed foods and that sort of thing. So that was a big piece for me, was simplicity with food.
I'm trying to think of other examples. We also focused a lot on food. We actually had our budget broken down to like 30% farmers market, like 70% growth, local market, and then also looking at what was unionized of the grocery stores, so a lot focusing on that. And we didn't buy any plastic bags all year. We just always, every time we'd go to conferences or something and we got little Ziploc bags, we'd bring them home and wash them. And so we had just like a box full of reused plastic Ziploc bags that we'd use for lunches. So that was new for me because I'd always buy Ziploc bags at the store to do that for a year. And
talk about our budget, like explain that.
Yeah, I'm curious about that. Sounds really, the budget around where to get the sources of food, that's interesting.
And money, yeah. So each of us have $90 a month for food. So it when you have 5 people living together, that's enough. Mm-hmm. If you're sharing meals, it's a lot more than if you're eating individually or in two. And then we had about $100 extra per month for shampoo or soap or warm pairs of socks in the winter. So we had to really think about our budget and how we're spending food for that $90 coming together. But our house, we actually had abundance, so we did a CSA over the summer, which is quite a lot of money compared to, it was like putting $500, but we had saved that put kind of $10 aside every month to partake in something that we really valued.
Mm-hmm. Did you make, was there a community process for deciding the budget, 30% on farmers market? I mean, how did you make that decision and make it intentional?
Yeah.
A lot of work?
Because different people have different values. So one person in our community really wanted to buy from places that were unionized, but our local co-op wasn't a union. Or part of a union, so talking about how different values and then the percentage. So that was our house session.
I think we focus a lot on like buying like from like local grocers and versus like Whole Foods, where like we can get like more organic foods from the local or from Whole Foods and things like that.
We experienced that tension.
Yeah, tension. But we were in a neighborhood that was in the process of gentrifying. So we were really trying to be aware of also like supporting our local businesses.
Mm-hmm. Which neighborhood are you in?
Humboldt Park.
Humboldt Park, and then St. Humboldt.
I was in Albany Park.
Albany Park, and then St. Paul, right? Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And another, I remember the first change that we made in our house was when we moved in, is we changed all of our light bulbs to CFL light bulbs, and just energy in general became on our minds collectively because those conversations kept coming up, and also in regard to water, both at just a everyday household usage level, and also like trying to minimize plastics and think about think about resources and alternative ways other than the immediately obvious.
And so when you started, when you began to live together a year ago, did you all know how to do this, or was there some learning, like now we have to figure out how to find this? Or I mean, did everybody come completely prepared to instantly live simply?
There was a lot of learning. Like I just mentioned light bulbs. I am a real like light person, and it totally freaked me out when, you know, I thought that this icky, gross kind of like light that comes out of CFLs as opposed to incandescent. And so it was just this short period of flexibility to the point where like I would never really have that debate again. I think being in community and having some challenge, like those challenges kind of grinding up against each other conversations is enough to like knock in some new habits.
Yeah, that reminds me that like you really learn a lot from since these are people that you don't know before, and like everyone's had different lifestyles growing up, and you learn a lot. Like one of the things that's really important to me is like every morning I wake up and I open all the curtains in our house, and for some of my roommates that was not something that they were used to doing in their houses growing up. It just wasn't something that they thought about doing, or their mom always did it or whatever, I don't know. So having that conversation of like, yes, we would like the natural light to come in so we don't have to turn on our dining room light, and like learning from each other in that process was definitely challenging at times, but good. We all came from different parts of the country, too.
Well, we need to start saving our power a lot, right? Because I think computers and some of the new tech, television and all the rest, you know, you can't just live in the fact that this abundance is going to be here forever and ever without some conservation. And as a child, I remember we were taught to turn off the light when you left.
Absolutely.
And that seems pretty simple, doesn't it?
A lost skill.
Or turn off your television, or can you have your computer on from 12 in the morning till 12 at night? I mean, if it starts with you and it gets contagious, we're going to get there.
Well, there's another factor to turning things off, and that is that a great many of our appliances drain electricity even when they're not in use. So if you have them plugged into a circuit breaker or something, so that you can turn that off.
But water consumption. What about water consumption? Where I had some laundry done, I spoke to the Vietnamese young woman who run the laundromat, who had just brought her mother to our country for the first time. She spoke of how she showered. She said, you know, in her language, you get in the shower and you let the water just run over you. You know, you don't have to turn it off when you're up. Well, this lady, she didn't even get in the shower. She couldn't get there because in her country, the water is not abundant. So she sat on the edge of the tub and got the water, did this, then, you know, and then turned the water back on and rinsed off. Mm-hmm. I mean.
So she had a lot of respect for it because it was not considered as abundant.
You know, and when we look back in history, water has been a huge, huge contention, and also scarcity.
Come to Holden in the wintertime, they have to do that. To be, not so much for the water, but for the hydropower to heat the water.
Yeah.
So people are strongly encouraged to soap up and then rinse off.
I have a question for our surprise guests. you know, you're of the generation that has iPods and laptops, and you really have, I think technology is much more a part of your life than it is for, it's a natural part of your life, whereas for the rest of it's varying areas, degrees of not so natural. So what do you have to say about technology and simple intentional living? I mean, would that be sort of a tension for you in your houses? Or?
Yeah, we've had a couple of these discussions, or probably come from different places, and but I didn't have a computer for the first, and I realized how hard it was not to Google Map something if I wanted to take, or even the bus, like I wanted to take the bus and realized I had to have all the papers rather than just look
online
for it, for schedules. So that was, or the weather, or things that I depend on the internet for, that's a or constantly wanting to check my email, those things. So the first half, that was a great lesson for me to simplify my mind in terms of technology.
Wait, so you didn't have it and you realized what you didn't have, but then you got a computer?
I brought it back from home. Yeah.
So your appreciation for it increased.
Yes.
Other perspectives?
It's really interesting talking to LVCers of like the past, because like 5 years ago, they didn't have like it was like just like common that you didn't bring your laptops at your LVC house. You didn't have internet. You didn't have any of those things. Cell phones, especially. Mm-hmm. Like that's why LVC houses have to have a landline, because like they still have that assumption that everyone's gonna come.
That you're not gonna have a cell phone.
Yeah, or you don't have to have a cell phone in the LVC or anything like that. So it's just really interesting to hear their perspective and then like kind of like how we've drifted so far and like not challenged ourselves as different. Like individually and also just as an organization in recent years, I think.
Speak up,
so
just a little bit.
Oh,
please.
We haven't been challenging ourselves in technology as much as like previous LVCers have.
Is that right? Ever no discussions around this?
No, I was going to say, looking like that's a really good question. I think it's something that my apartment could have been a lot more conscious of. And looking back, there were times when I had four other roommates, and all five of us would have our laptops out at the kitchen table and all be doing different things. And
community.
I mean, yeah, looking back, like that could have been something that we talked about more, and we're like, okay, let's have this time that we aren't attached to our laptops or we aren't going to talk on our cell phones.
I hope you weren't emailing each other.
But it really separates you, even though you're in the same room. And That's a really good question. They should put that into the LVC orientation, because that's really not something that we talked about, but that is definitely changing over the years, like these last couple of years with LVC.
And it was, I think that Jacob and I experienced a unique tension because we both had our job placements were very technologically. I did digital youth media, and Jacob did like programming.
I programmed for a nonprofit.
So they brought their work home sometimes.
And so, you know, a part of being vocationally, you know, talented in our work and in our sites of service were, you know, intermixed with technology, being with it and so forth. So that was interesting.
Well, I'm struggling with this just for me, but I'm thinking that... I'm old enough, obviously, to know what it was like with pencil and paper and the beginning of the use of the computer, but I'm also to the point where in my career I needed that computer, you know, I needed that. And so now that has been a connection point for me. So I'm not so sure that, I struggle with, does simple living mean you have to give up that connection to get the weather or to get the bus schedules. I mean, these are things in the past, there were other options, but is that not a good way to use your time and use the time you would have spent tracking this other stuff down for other things? So I kind of struggle with, does that mean that that's bad? Does that mean that that's not simple? Yes. Four of you at the table at the same time immersed in that is excess, maybe, or, you know, if there's not community spent elsewhere, but still, I don't see that as being bad.
I think it comes back to that intentionality.
By the time, busyness.
Well, in the case of our family, siblings and whatnot, we actually have built community through a common shared website.
Exactly.
People are communicating almost daily on that with each other. So it's not that we see somebody once every 2 or 3 months and get an update. It's we know what's going on with everyone.
It's just begun to be the way things are, So I don't see that as necessarily an either or kind
of. I definitely think, though, it's still probably healthy to take a step back and see, like, how much time you're spending on it, or, like, do you spend so much time to the exclusion of other?
Who uses a typewriter anymore?
That would be an interesting Lenten activity. You don't have to get 40 days without my computer. Would be really tough. But what if you said, okay, let's try 72 hours, or, you know, just to see, just to observe what your habits are. Or limit. It would be an interesting thing to see, to explore this question.
Excuse me, one other comment I'd just like to make, because I had to smile when I heard you say this, creative use of the baggies and taking them home. And immediately it brought to my mind growing up and my mother washing out bread bags and hanging them over the faucet to dry for reuse.
Faucet,
and
yep.
I just a flashback.
It's still possible to do that.
I do that.
I love washing out my plastic bags.
Yeah. All the Ziploc bags?
Yeah.
Oh,
you
yeah.
get several uses out of them.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Until they start to leak, you know.
And I think we probably have about 5 minutes here, so we'll wrap up. So just tell the way that your connection to the congregation happened from LVC House and your sponsoring congregation. Was there space made for you to talk about your experiences or have conversations with people or share what you were learning with the congregation that was sponsoring them?
I think if there was, it was informal in like coffee hour, you know, like just talking
mm-hmm.
to people. Like people were curious, I think, like. If they knew that you were an LVC-er, I think
mm-hmm.
people would generally come up to you and talk to you about either their experiences or want to know about your experiences. So.
Mm-hmm.
But so it was really informal and through coffee hour.
I definitely think there could be more of
mm-hmm.
that. I mean, that would be a...
Mm-hmm.
So do you guys stand out as different in groups?
Like groups of peers,
you mean? Like
yeah.
relative
yeah.
to our well, friends?
I
don't
like I guess your peer groups, the people that you interact with
mm-hmm.
and so on.
Good
I mean, are you... I mean.
I think something like for the busyness or the going out, like whenever I have a lot of friends that want to go out for coffee or out for dinner, and I normally have to different lifestyle, like, oh, let's go for a walk because I can't afford that. Or so that's, I think I've noticed my lifestyle has, or and I'd like to continue that change of not having that consumerism. Let's go out and do something.
So your budget changed
yeah.
the way you use time.
Uh-huh. I mean, and comparing it with, like, friends who did not do LDC,
yeah.
sometimes it's challenging to explain to them, like,
yeah.
why your budget is so important or, you know, what you're doing living with these strangers
yeah,
halfway
exactly.
across the country from where
yeah.
you grew up.
Uh-huh.
And, you know,
for sure.
people don't do that.
Sure. But thank you for doing it. Thank you for
yeah.
taking on
mm-hmm.
that kind of part and that kind of responsibility. And you guys will just be really witnesses to the fact that this can be done, and people will look at you and see,
mm-hmm.
you know, that you're very normal.
Yeah.
You're wealthy.
New normal.
You know, you're part of the society. Hello.
What are your hometowns?
Thank you.
I grew up in Boise, Idaho.
I grew up in Seattle.
Seattle.
Mm-hmm. Kirkland, Washington.
Mount Vernon, Washington.
Okay, so, you know, connect with the congregation here. Maybe if you're from
yeah.
one of these areas, invite them over and have a coffee hour and start your simplicity circle
no,
with
true,
your
yeah.
special guests, people who've lived through, I mean, the whole discernment part in the beginning of having to decide how to do this is it's the big learning step for us. Nobody says wakes up and says, I got it. And, yeah, your assets, you're on the list. LVC graduates. Right
thanks
there.
For listening.
Sorry,
for
I skewed that towards
sorry.
Missionaries. I forgot LVCers are very, very obvious asset
yeah,
of church.
If you know anyone who wants, it's a great program. Do you highly recommend it?
Lots of alumni here too.
Yeah,
and it's kind of cool because we're at the end of that year, but
yeah.
it's but all of this stuff is more relevant to our lives than ever, and I think that's the unique piece. Like it's like we're all. We're not in some special place. Like, it's all, we're on the same journey, you know?
Yeah.
What a community. You built a real community.
Yeah.
And it probably will last your lifetimes.
This is a one-year commitment. It is. It's August to August. And Holden has graciously given us this week to kind of come. And,
all right.
So
oh.
we're really grateful for that.
Mm-hmm.
Are there some
yeah.
more LVCs here? How many
there's
are there?
Six.
There's two more.
Oh, great.
Right.
Well, that's a real benefit if LBC comes with a week at Holden at the end of it.
Yeah.
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's good. How many, we just tell people what cities LBC is active in and where the programs are? Is this like Denver?
It's Seattle and Tacoma.
Bay Area.
Yeah.
Milwaukee, Twin Cities, Chicago, D.C.,
Delaware.
And then they're opening up next
Omaha,
year.
Nebraska.
Omaha and Nebraska this year. Next year, Atlanta. And next year,
Detroit.
Yeah.
Is there a waiting list?
I mean, it was.
Yeah.
There was a really lot of people that applied, especially this
yeah.
last year. So in this economy
that's
right now,
there's
kind of a waiting list.
There's so much interest.
And the more you guys that come out and tell the story, I'm sure a lot more
folks would. Lutheran Volunteer Corps, cells of resistance. You're already there. Well, thank you, everybody. It's probably time for lunch. Thank you for those who came most days this week. It's great. Thank you all for coming.
Before we go, you know, there's another interesting book out that you guys have probably heard of. It's called Not Buying It. Has anybody heard of that?
No.
This woman wrote this book, Not Buying It. And for 1 year, she and her husband decided they were not going to buy anything unless it was almost an emergency. And it is very interesting to see how they did that. Like for entertainment, they wouldn't go out, and their friends would invite them because they felt sorry for them. They would buy tickets for them to go somewhere, and they said, you know, this is not that we are poor, that we are destitute. It's just we wanted to see if that can be done. And really, when you talk to people, I've said to people, you know, we're talking this economy, and I said, you know, I look in my closet. I don't need another pair of shoes. I don't need another blouse. I don't need another sweater. And everybody agrees with you because this is so true. We all have so much stuff. It's crazy.
Mm-hmm.
But her, I thought that book was quite an eye-opener.
Cool. I forgot to give a little ad for myself. This is my email. So, you know, I was in Chicago. I was presenting to Chicago churches. Now I'm coming out west. And I'd be happy to come to talk to church or lead this thing. I'll be in Seattle at the end of September, beginning of October. Then I'll be going through Portland. Then I'll be mostly doing Northern California and back in Seattle maybe in November. So I'd love to talk about this. I'd be happy to turn your church basement into a cell of resistance. So
thank you,
just to know, it'd be a great hot ticket to get there.